Thanks.
That's Zoom's new way of letting you know we're being recorded, but so you can adjust your hair and makeup if you need to, but really it should be just recording me and not you guys, so your confidentiality is protected. So it's great to be here, and I've been thinking a lot about Sangha, given how long we've been around together and what a wonderful thing it is, and thinking about where some of our communities were 20 years ago. And so it's wonderful. And wanted to talk a little bit about tonight about one of the some of the important things about being in a sangha such as this one. And so it's I've crossed my mind recently that if you believe, and I do, that there's suffering in life, and if you believe that it's caused by greed, hate, and delusion, as the Buddha has taught us, and that the way we practice these days, we know that most of that greed, hate, and delusion is completely made up in my own mind, a process of my own ego. My sense of needing to control things, of being safe and connected on the high side. Then we have some reason, I think, to really build a practice based on suffering. And many of you have been to talks before and have maybe built your own practices that way. This weekend, I had the occasion, the last 4 days, to be at three Dharma talks. That focused, I was at four Dharma talks, three of which focused specifically and completely on the teaching of the First Noble Truth. There is suffering, the truth of suffering. And so for many people, that is where it begins, and where they where where the practice that they undertake begins. And Mel Weitzman, who was formerly the abbot at Berkeley Zen Center, said no one showed up at the door of a zendo unbroken. And so people come to spiritual practices, Buddhism and others, because we're looking for some sense of peace and ease and healing and soothing. But the talks that I heard this weekend really sort of had the sense that that there is suffering in the world and that there will always be suffering. Suffering is the First Noble Truth. And specifically said in one of those talks that if you live, if you don't, I'm using the word algorithm, but to not live in the paradigm or algorithm of suffering is to be delusional. And then the other Dharma talk said that if we properly do Zazen, sitting meditation, it will allow us to arouse the truth of suffering. And so I thought immediately that I didn't need Zazen to arouse the truth of suffering. I was quite familiar with suffering at various points in my life. But I did what I did feel, and it's just for me, it's not for anybody else, but I felt deeply saddened by these teachings. And I felt more saddened by the discussions that followed that were what I would refer to as participants as suffering enthusiasts. And they talked about suffering and the reality of suffering and how deeply important suffering was to them, and all of that can be true. But for me, I've been at this now for just about 30 years this year, practicing Buddhism. And what I want to share with you is that it can be different than that. And my way is no better than anybody else's, but it can be different. My Buddha said that that there was one teaching, that Buddha came to have one teaching, suffering and an end to suffering. So there is the truth of suffering, but the Buddha is quoted as having said one teaching, the suffering and the end to suffering. And my personal Buddha did not say to look deeply and accept your suffering and then sit down in your suffering and stay there. That's not what my Buddha said. My Buddha said no mud, no lotus flower. And so the teaching, that teaching had to do with, yeah, things, there are realities in life that are out of our control, most things actually, and that causes suffering. And that if we want them to be other than they are, that causes more suffering, but that it doesn't have to be that way. And so I believe that there's an end to suffering. And I believe that the way that we end suffering is by working a practice, a robust practice, So, you know, I certainly have, speaking of that lotus, no mud, no lotus, I've certainly been muddy many times in my life. So often or occasionally these days, but often in the past, getting right in that mud and splashing around. And these days I try to focus on the lotus flower. Because my thoughts, words, and actions can sometimes be self-protecting, and hopefully fewer times just plain self-serving. And you know, as I have said here before, I'm a queen of a certain age, and so we like creature comforts. And so sometimes, you know, in the midst of my deep spiritual practice, I just want something. And if I'm really having an off spiritual day, then I think I deserve something. So that my practice of deep spiritual practice has to be balanced at all times. But if I accept those proclivities in myself, then I know that what I have to do is spend a lot of time practicing metta and loving kindness. And this occurs for me in two ways. One is the actual practice of metta, and the other is agatha practice, which I've talked about here before, which is just a way of stopping each day once or twice and saying, how am I doing in terms of being the kind of spiritual person I'd like to be? And then making some sort of agatha simply means a little vow that we create for ourselves. And there are books full of them in Buddhism, but we're really encouraged to make up our own. I've decided that I need to practice loving kindness because it doesn't do me any good to encounter people in Sangha or in my workplace or in my family and not extend loving kindness to all of them. And so that can cause suffering. Because some people that I don't want to extend loving kindness to, it's because they're horrible, or at least in my judgment at that moment, and some of them I'm just feel neutral about. It's like, oh, you know, they talk too much, or they do this, or they do that, and so I'm feeling neutral. But what I figured out is that I can physically move away from a person such as that, or I can diminish or dismiss a person like that from my immediate environment. But the fact is, they don't go away. The fact is, they are still in community. They are still a person in need of love. They are still a person who perhaps has been hurt, and needs to be hurt and needs to be healed. Excuse me. Needs to be hurt. That was a Freudian slip. They need to be healed. And so if I can't extend healing and compassion and love, the chances are it's not that they're going to be any less annoying or any less aggressive. It's just that they're going to go do it with someone else besides me. And so as I think about Sangha and community and our responsibility, I get the chance to say, okay, so if I'm not willing to practice a robust loving kindness practice, then I'm not really not doing what I set out to do. So, you know, as I say, I realize that the attachments, that suffering for me comes a lot because I get attached to things being as I want them to be. So my Gatha practice, I have a number of little vows that I say each day, and they rotate through the seasons. But lately, one of them has been the very profoundly spiritual Gatha practice that is this: what the F are you doing? That's my practice to myself. What are you doing? And I, you know, as we've gone through quarantine, and now we're coming out of quarantine, and you know, who knows where we're going from here. So I just take a look at myself and think, why are you being impatient with people that are or not wearing masks or are or not doing whatever it is that you know come to Sangha and do such and such, or come to the workplace and do such and such. And so then I get impatient with myself, and it's like, okay, so let's ask the question, what's going on? And you know, often it's that I'm having that judgment or that feeling, but what's really going on is something deeper than that that I get to take a look at in myself, a sense of fear or anger or frustration, or disrespect or whatever it might be. So when I say that to myself, what the F are you doing? I get to smile, sometimes even laugh a little bit, because I know that in our Buddhist practice, that I'm not a bad human being, that I'm not a bad person. I know, in fact, that it's just being human, that we all have the full range of emotions that make us human beings, and that we get to honor those and not deny them and not pretend that they're not there. I like that quote that we've said here a couple times in the last this year that I recall from Deschardins that says, we are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are in fact spiritual beings trying to have a human experience in this chaotic and confusing world we live in. So I think that I spent a lot of time in over the last probably 10, 20 years thinking about how a disciple of the Buddha should behave. And I know that I've spent a lot of time over many years trying to think of how a longtime LGBTQ plus advocate, social justice and health justice advocate, what kind of things should that person be putting in the community consciousness in terms of ideas and bonding and compassion and so forth. And the truth is that sometimes, even though I think about those things and I know what some of the answers are, some days I'm just tired or distracted, or I just veer away from the path a little bit. And I find myself, when I do my daily check-in practice, just saying to myself, am I producing peace and ease in the community, or am I producing chaos and disunity, or am I being neutral, which for me is not an acceptable alternative. So in the beautiful poem that we study in Zen called The Mind of Absolute Trust, there's a wonderful teaching for all of us that says the great way is not difficult for those unattached to their preferences. The great way, the Buddha way, is not difficult for those unattached to their preferences. And, you know, when I first heard that, I thought, wow, you know, coming in new to Buddhism, and I had a lot of preferences. And truthfully, at age 70, I still have a lot of preferences, although I try to keep them in a context of good for all versus just good for me. So importantly, it was pointed out to me as I began to study that beautiful poem, and it may make sense for all of you too, that it doesn't say that the path of the good, the path, the great path, is easy for those with no preferences. What it says is it's easy for those who are not attached to those preferences. So acknowledging that we have preferences, all for all sorts of things, how we spend our time, who we spend our time with, what sort of data and information we take in, what sort of data and information we put out. So, you know, I think that it's really important to say, so on a day-to-day basis, I'm not trying to be the Buddha. Even the Buddha wasn't trying to be the Buddha on a day-to-day basis. We are these spiritual beings trying to survive in a human world. And so that becomes really important as we have reasonable reactions to unreasonable things that happen in the world, injustice, oppression, abuse, etc. So one of the gathas that I really love and that I'm happy to share with all of you was taught by Thich Nhat Hanh. And Thich Nhat Hanh's gatha that he shared was, I vow to understand and remember how well-being arises. I vow to understand and remember how well-being arises. I must be able to distinguish between what is healthful and what is harmful. And so that's a really beautiful gatha, that if I stop saying, am I doing something right or wrong or bad or evil or, you know, you know, inconsiderate or any sort of judgment that I might put on myself, if I just say instead that the reason I woke up this morning was to hopefully arouse well-being for myself and others. And then the question is simple, did I do that? Am I doing that? So the fact is that most of us, myself very much included, when we're faced with disrespect or hurt or confusion, or, you know, we've lost a job or we didn't get the housing we wanted, or we lost the housing we wanted, or we didn't get the vaccinations on the day we wanted it, we turn to our habit behaviors. And that's just a way of soothing. For some people, that becomes addiction of various kinds. And we know throughout recorded history, people have used substances, including alcohol and food and all sorts of things for healing and soothing. But even those of us that don't have traditional addictions have habitual behaviors that we fall into that we find soothing. For some of us, that might be isolation, could be whatever. For some of us, it's being more aggressive, perhaps. And so we have these behaviors. And a person named Rabbi Rami Shapiro puts it this way, we become inured both to our emotions and to our habitual behavior. We make excuses for them both. We stop worrying about being our authentic self because we can no longer remember any other self than this reactive habitual self. and the suffering that we have caused begins to overshadow and outweigh any good that we may have done. And so his advice to us all, and advice that I share, is that as we create a spiritual practice for ourselves, and it's very individual in many cases, that his definition of spirituality is the ever-deepening capacity to embrace life with justice, compassion, curiosity, awe, wonder, serenity, and humility. So it's just a menu of things that as we wake up in the morning or we go to a particular meeting or some activity during the day, we have this chance to say, all I have to remember is how to arouse well-being in myself and in others. And so, you know, in the last 16 months, we've had lots of opportunities to arouse well-being and watch it go away. And so I think the question is, how do we, if human beings are prone to negative self-judgment and not being very fair to ourselves in terms of our judgments, how do we then figure it out whether or not we are arousing well-being and what well-being even means? And is it my definition, which sometimes could be self-serving or self-protective, or is it my definition when I'm in a spiritual place in Sangha with all of you or in community? And so I think the way we do that is by being in Sangha. And I have said here before, and the story is very famous of Ananda, the disciple of the Buddha, who said, Buddha, I figured out that the spiritual practice, half of the spiritual practice, half of a good life is having good spiritual friends. And the Buddha said, oh, no, Ananda, don't say that. All of the spiritual life is having good spiritual friends. And so as we look around at the folks that are here today, Eli and Summer, who are here for the first time, and Carl, who's been here since they laid the bricks, and all of us in between, we have this opportunity to turn to each other and just share our experience. What, you know, how are we living, and how are we taking in the message of the Buddha, and how are we taking in the message of freedom and liberation in our communities? And to ask the question very simply, is this reasonable? You know, if I set off to do something, I used to be very famous for wanting to help all of you and fix all of you. And somewhere about 10 years into my spiritual practice, someone said, we don't actually need you today to fix anything. We'd like you to hang around with us, but, you know, just as one of us. And when we want you to help us fix something, we'll let you know. And that's an important message for all of us to learn. I think we can, and we do, every time we think beyond the idea of ourself, we get, I think I shared last month, this is a little Irish vow. Here's another of the gathas that I say every day. And it says, I vow to forgive in you the things that cause me pain when I see them in me. I vow to forgive in you the things that cause me pain when I see them in me. So there are just a number of little gathas, prayers that you can say during the day that help me to stay out of me and into us. And that's what Sangha is for. And I believe that that's why this one has survived for so very long, is that we have that opportunity. On a fun note, if you have not read an article in the New York Times this past week, it's called There is a Special Kind of Joy. I can send it to you. You could look it up. It talks about collective effervescence. And I love that expression, collective effervescence. And what it basically is saying is that we are happier and more satisfied and less at risk as human beings when we're in a collective. And that there have been studies done, we can imagine it, but there have actually been studies done where they take a look that human beings are happier and feel safer when they're operating in unison. In a sangha, in a group of some kind. The old thinking used to be that happiness was a state of mind and that melancholy is a potential warning sign, perhaps even of mental illness, of depression or whatever. But what this article talks about is the reality is that emotions are inherently social. They're woven through our interactions and that peak happiness is mostly through a collective activity. And there are studies done now, particularly over the last 14 months, that things like depression and anxiety that were happening to people who were suddenly locked up together for 24/7 were actually finding that experience of sort of almost catching not just COVID, because many people didn't catch that, but that what they were catching was the depression, the sadness, the anxiety, the trouble that other folks were feeling. But what we know, going to the theme of tonight's talk, is that Thich Nhat Hanh said, "I vow to understand and remember how well-being arises." And what this article, this wonderful, fun article, and I hope you all get a chance to read it. It's just a couple pages. That through connecting, caring, and contributing, people appear to be more likely to gain well-being. So when we try to think for ourselves, how do we arouse well-being? One of the ways is that we do it by being right here with one another. And so I'm going to close. This is a poem I've read before, but I really like it, and it really fits in right here for all of us. In the midst of hate, I found there was within me an invincible love. In the midst of tears, I found there was within me an invincible smile. In the midst of chaos, I found there was within me an invincible calm. I realized through it all that in the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer. And that makes me happy. For it says that no matter how hard the world pushes against me, within me, there's something stronger, something better, pushing right back. And what we know is that when we join together, and we are pushing together for the things that will arouse well-being and keep us healthy, we are actually being good disciples of the Buddha, and we are much more likely to be able to lead a life that acknowledges suffering and that recognizes the truth that there is an end to suffering, and that the end to suffering is coming together in Sangha and following the Eightfold Path. So thank you, everyone.
Stephen, thank you so much for that Dharma talk. Really appreciate it. Well, as we close, let's sit together for a couple of minutes to dedicate the merit with some metta.